do efforts to promote breastfeeding work?
Does oxygen help in people that have emphysema?
How about testing kids for elevated cholesterol when their family has that issue?
And a true State of the Union report for cigarette smoking-induced cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 28th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, why don't we turn to this thing you served up as the State of the Union with regard to cigarette smoking. That's in JAMA Internal Medicine, a rather interesting variation in cigarette smoking state by state.
I was unaware that smoking attributable cancer mortality estimates, although they're available nationally, aren't available state by state. So I was kind of surprised. That's why this particular study piqued my interest. They looked at each of the 50 states in the District of Columbia to see what cancer was attributable to cigarette smoking. And these are cancers like leukemia, cancers of the pharynx and throat, cancers of the lung, obviously, even GI cancers, kidney cancers. And here's what they discovered. They estimated that approximately 167,000 cancer deaths in 2014 were due to or attributable to cigarette smoking. But it varied substantially by states, from a low of 22% in Utah to a high of almost 40% in Arkansas. Interestingly enough, 9 of the top 10 ranked states for men and 6 of the top 10 states ranked for women related to cigarette smoking-induced cancer were located in the South. And in fact, in the top 5 ranked states, smoking explained nearly 40% of cancer deaths. So what this tells me is there's a huge disparity state to state, and this should give us some insight about how we ought to address the issue.
Also, there was significant variation with regard to women and men.
There was. In fact, the incidence of cigarette smoking-induced cancer was almost twice as high in men than women, although it's been increasing in women because a larger proportion of them are now smoking as well. Now, I serve this up as it has implications. When we're treating individuals that are at risk for having heart attack, we look at those that are considered to be at high risk, those that have high blood pressure, diabetes, or high cholesterol, or cigarette smokers, and we target the high-risk individuals. This tells me we should target the states that have the highest risk of cigarette-induced cancer as well, particularly those in the South. What sort of things can we do? Well, we can ban cigarette smoking in public places, and in many of these states, that's not been done. We can increase taxes on cigarettes. And these states in the South, these are the states that grow tobacco, so the cigarette taxes are not very high. We can increase the number of programs about education on cigarette smoking. And many of these states have a paucity of those as well. So this tells me by having this information, we can target these particular states.
It seems like a real shame because the South also has a higher proportion of obesity and diabetes as well as cigarette smoking.
You're right. And again, this type of information that drills down to specific areas of the country is very valuable for targeting the individuals we need to educate and to change their lifestyle.
Since we're talking about education then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This look at, hey, what about increasing or promoting breastfeeding?
And although 80% of the infants in the United States start breastfeeding, only 22% are exclusively breastfed up to 6 months. That's recommended by a number of professional organizations. So how do we increase that? Well, there are a number of different interventions that have been tried, either at the individual level. When I say individual level, these are things where the mother is provided either individual or group counseling by professionals or peer support groups or even structured education. Conversely, there are system level interventions that include hospital staff training and hospital policies as well. So what this study attempted to do was to look at all the studies that have looked at these interventions, examine the effectiveness of these individual or system-level interventions to see how effective they were at increasing the use of breastfeeding. And what they discovered is that the system-level efforts really did not do that, but the individual efforts did. They increased the incidence of breastfeeding from about 11 to 20%, depending upon the different types of individual interventions used.
Well, okay, so what's it take to employ individual interventions? What are the barriers?
Actually, very few barriers. We need to have people that are professionally trained to do this. We need to supply peer support groups as well. So this, to me, seems like it's very easy to do. And then also individual-based education. And it's fairly cost-effective.
All right. Sounds like something that needs to be gotten underway on a more widespread basis. Let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. I said, hey, if parents have high cholesterol, how about testing those kids for high cholesterol also, so-called familial hypercholesterolemia?
That particular condition is the one that's associated with the highest levels of cholesterol and a very early mortality. Individuals can have heart attacks or strokes in their teens and as very young adults. So these are the individuals we really want to target. Well, what these investigators attempted to do was realizing that it's a very rare condition is, can we use a primary care setting to identify kids and subsequently their parents, which are going to be fairly young, to identify who might have this familial hypercholesterolemia. So they measured using a capillary blood sample, that is a finger stick. They measured cholesterol levels in up to 10,000 children 1 to 2 years of age. And these were kids that were presented to the doctor for the routine immunization. And among those, they were able to identify about 0.3% of children that had hypercholesterolemia. And subsequently able to test their parents to show that many of those parents also had markedly elevated cholesterol levels as well. What that means is for every 1,000 children screened, about 8 persons, 4 children and 4 adults, were identified as having screened positive for familial hypercholesterolemia. That put them at an extremely high risk of cardiovascular disease and obviously eligible for treatment with statins.
How much of this is really unknown? It seems to me that everybody I know who has familial hypercholesterolemia knows they have it.
I guess there are two parts to that question. How many of these children or parents, this was their first revelation, and in all of these it was, the earlier you detect it and the earlier you treat it, the better chance you have of lowering the cardiovascular risk. So identifying in children that are 1 or 2 years of age or their parents can be very helpful for diagnosing it early.
What about intervention?
Well, the primary interventions, obviously, to lower cholesterol. And the most effective way we have is prescribing statins. But for individuals in whom the cholesterol can't be lowered, we have additional medications now. For individuals that even that's not effective, we can actually filter their blood as well. But that's rarely necessary.
Excellent. So it's probably a good idea then to employ this screening.
I think it's a great opportunity because the kids are already being immunized as well. And if we can identify those that have high cholesterol in an easy, cost-effective way, I think it's effective.
Finally, let's turn to something that's rather disappointing. In people who have COPD or emphysema, supplemental oxygen doesn't look like it's really very helpful.
So we're going to limit our discussion primarily to people that are considered to have moderate COPD or moderate emphysema. When I say moderate, that is their blood saturation, which should be 98 or 99%, hovers somewhere between 89 to 93%, either at rest or with exercise. And the reason why I'm limiting it to these individuals is people that have severe emphysema, marked desaturation, oxygen has been helpful. But we don't know about this moderate range. So that's what the purpose of the study was. It was designed to test whether long-term treatment with supplemental oxygen resulted in a better outcome, a longer time to death or a longer time to hospitalization in people with moderate COPD or moderate emphysema. So in looking at 738 individuals at 42 centers followed over 1 to 6 years, those randomized to supplemental oxygen as opposed to those that did not had no better outcome. It did not affect the time to death or the time to the first hospitalization, the time to the first exacerbation of their emphysema, the rate of all hospitalizations, the rate of emphysema exacerbations, or even the quality of life. So in these individuals, either with resting or exercise-induced moderate desaturation, supplemental oxygen was not helpful.
Again, this is good news, of course, because it then alleviates the need to haul around one of those canisters and to do all the rest of that stuff. It's a little disappointing, though, isn't it?
You're right. We would all like to administer some therapy or some medication that is beneficial. Conversely, we don't want to be giving a medication or a therapy that's not helpful. In this particular case, this well-done study shows supplemental oxygen isn't helpful.
Right. I guess it's back to the drawing board with regard to interventions for moderate COPD, of course, increasing tremendously according to data from the WHO. On that note, I think I'm going to talk about the breastfeeding study that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.